set the Sanhedrin, we'll take a look at the first Mishnah, which is a gigantic Mishnah. You have the whole page, it's just one Mishnah. And do we have the original Gemara here? All right, so we'll keep the original Gemara here in case we need it. So Dine Mominos Bishlosha. So the Mishnah is addressing the question of how many judges, what's the minimal number of dayanim that have to sit on a bezdin, and there are three categories. There's the, shall I say, the nitty gritty basic bezdin, and that's made up of three judges. Then we're going to have a higher court, which is going to be made up of 23 judges. And then we're going to have the highest court in Israel, which is the Supreme Court. That's made up of 71 elders. And we're going to try to figure out in what cases and in what judgments do we need these various numbers of judges on the court. So the first level is called Dine Mominos, which is monetary law. Just make sure it's on silent. Do you know how to do that? Yeah, thanks. And if it's a case of monetary law, then all we need is the basic number, you know what I say, the bare bones number of judges, and that's three judges. Okay. Now, this within Dini Mominos, we can break down Dini Mominos into two categories. One category is what we call civil law, and the other is called criminal law. Meaning, when you have to decide a monetary case, it doesn't only mean that you're trying to figure out who owes who money because he borrowed or because he purchased an object and he hasn't paid for it. It could also mean that he has to pay money because he's guilty of a crime. So there's a fundamental difference between borrowing money and stealing money. In both cases, the common denominator is that you have to pay a price. But in the first case, where you borrowed money, you're paying a price because the money is rightfully his. You didn't steal it from him, but you have to pay him. You borrowed money, you have to return the money. In the second case, where you stole the money, that's already a criminal case. There you have to pay not only because you're holding on to his possession, but you have to pay compensation. So for example, if Reuven were to steal Shimon's sheep and then he slaughtered the sheep, he would have to pay, the gazlan would have to pay the value of the sheep as it were at the time it was alive when he stole it. And that would be a chiyuv of gzela. So let's say for example he stole a sheep and at the time the sheep was worth 10, now there was inflation or there was depression and there was a change in the market value of that sheep. He would pay the market value of the sheep at the moment of the gzela, the moment that he stole it. Now, even within this distinction between civil law and criminal law, there's what I call the gray area or the overlap between the two. And that's called kofer bipikadon. Okay? Kofer bipikadon. Let's see. Okay, I don't see if we can write this on the board. Okay, I haven't been here in a while, so we need a black thing. Anyway, if you can write it in your own handwriting on the side here, kofer bipikadon. And then we have another category. I'll explain what kofer bipikadon means in just a second, which is called sholach yad bipikadon. Now, what's common to both of these cases is that there's a certain element of criminal law involved over here. Why? Because the Torah considers in both these cases the shomer. What's the English translation of the word shomer? I used to know.
Guardian.
A guardian? No.
Watchman?
Watchman. I think there's another word. But anyway, we'll call it a guardian or a watchman.
What kind of shomer?
But I mean a classic shomer. There's a word in English for shomer. I forgot exactly what it is. In any event, the Torah considers the shomer as a gazlan in these two cases. Case number one is called kofer bipikadon. Imagine Reuven gives Shimon a sheep and he tells Shimon and Shimon accepts the status as a shomer, so he has to guard the sheep. And then he denies that he ever got the sheep. That's called kofer. Kofer means denial. Bipikodo. Pikodo means in a deposit, something that was deposited in his possession. So if you take a look at Rashi, on the top of the page, do you see the word gzelos? And Rashi says, kofer bipikodon. Kofer bipikodon. Do you see those two words?
Yeah, yeah.
So that means he denies that he received the pikodon. So that's one case where the Torah considers him a gazlan. And there's another case, which is called shaleach boyad. You'll see that in Rashi also. Shaleach boyad means that if, let's say, the let's call him Reuven. Reuven gives a horse. Let's give an example of a horse over to Shimon. He says, Shimon, I want to pay you to horse watch. You know, you watch my horse and I'll pay you for that, or you'll do it for me gratis. Now, in such a case, Shimon, the shomer, is not allowed to use the object. He is purely responsible for protecting the object, but he doesn't have any rights to use the object. If he uses the object for his own purposes, then in such a case, he is called Sholeach Yad B'Pikadon, which literally translates, he sends his hand to the Pikadon. Means he stretches out his hand and he uses it, he benefits from it. And Rashi says, Havi Gazlan. Those are the two key words here in Rashi. In both these cases of Kofer B'Pikadon or Sholeach Yad B'Pikadon, if he denies that he ever received the object, that denial constitutes an act of gzela, according to the Torah, or alternatively, if he uses the object for his own purposes, then the Torah considers him a gazlan. So again, on the one hand, it's a monetary case, but on the other hand, you can see where there's a criminal element into the that has to be added into the equation. V'chein, and then we get to the classic case of a gazlan, ha-choteif miyad chavera. He literally puts his hand into someone's pocket, and he takes out his wallet. That's called chotev. He grabs it miyad chaver from the possession of his friend, havi gazlan. That's already a classic gazlan. Kegon, and here Rashi quotes a pasuk in Tanakh, vayigzola sachanis miyad amitzri. Now, this gzelos is in the classic case is defined by the Tanakh as grabbing something out of someone else's hand, out of his possession. So in the cases of Kofer B'Pikadon, he didn't grab anything out of the possession, because actually the sheep came into his possession willingly. It was given over to him and transferred by the mafkid, by the owner of the sheep. Or in the case of Sholeach Yad B'Pikadon, you know, the mafkid is nowhere to be found. It's not like the shomer grabbed it from the mafkid. But nevertheless, in these cases, the Torah considers it like the case of Ayigzol Asachanis Miyad Amitzri, like the classic case of Gzela, where he puts his hand into his friend's pocket, so to speak, and takes something out of the pocket.
Is there significance to the fact that it's a goy?
Who? The Mitzri. Owner of the object is a goy? Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I see what you're saying. If you hold the Gezlakim Doraisa, then it makes sense. If you hold the Gezlakim Lav Doraisa, okay. We're not ready for that yet, but yeah, that's a good point. Now, what's a case of pure civil law, which has no no bearing to gzelos? Avolava, if a person borrows money and he hasn't yet returned it, lo shilem, then lo mikri gazlan. That's not considered gzela. Now, why isn't that considered gzela? I mean, after all, he's holding on to so and so's possession. I mean, he borrowed $1,000. Oh, so the answer is that gzela always has to relate to an object, a very specific concrete object, not to a theoretical value or sum. When we're talking about a theoretical value or sum, that's not called gzela. So for example, in the case of a love who's borrowing money, the malve puts down on the love's table a bag of gold coins. Now, if the love denies or refuses to repay him, has he stolen an object? A specific concrete object? L'chor, yes, because that was the bag of coins, and now he's not willing to give back the bag of coins. So Rashi says, if you take a look, you have to underline the last three words in Rashi, demilve lahotzah nitna. Okay, then this is again a challenging concept, but what it basically means is that when I give you, I'm the malv and you're the loaf, I give you a bag of coins, those coins belong to you, meaning to the lover, to the one who borrowed the money. He's not going to return those coins. He's obligated to pay an abstract value. So let's say there were 100 coins. Each coin was worth one. So he owes him 100. And if he denies payment on the 100, then there's a civil case. But that's not gzela. Why isn't that gzela? Because gzela means when you steal an object. So for example, if I give you a sheep, I want that sheep back. If you refuse to give it back to me, you're a gazlan. That's called kofer b'pikadon. Or for example, the act of using the sheep when you had no right to do so, that's called gzela. Because that's on a specific concrete object. Again, if I had a way of writing on the board, I would add the word be'en. Be'en, be'ez, ayin, yud, nun, means a specific concrete object. That's called gzela. But in the case of an abstract chov, and again, if I had a blackboard, I had a possibility I'd write this on the board, and that's the word chov, ches, vav, be'ez, that's an abstract value, which you can convert into currency depending upon what country you're in. You know, if you're Canadian dollars, American dollars, Israeli shekel, whatever it might be. So in the case of a halva, of a loan, if the lova denies the loan, he's not stealing a specific concrete object, which is called a be'en, he's only stealing a chov, right? He has an abstract value that he has to pay, and he doesn't want to pay that. He refuses to pay it. So he's stealing something that's abstract as opposed to something that's concrete. He's stealing a chov rather than a be'en. And in such a case, that's not called gzela. That's called dine mamonos. That's a monetary case. So now I'm going to test you guys, okay? This is a quiz question. Are you up to it? If you passed it, I don't know, I should offer you some sort of a gift. I don't know. Okay, so here's the quiz question. Reuven lends Shimon 1,000, and Shimon denies receiving the 1,000, or alternatively, he refuses to repay the 1,000. What category does that come under? Is that called gzelos, or is that called dini momenos? Excellent, dini momenos. Now here's case number two. Reuven gives Shimon a sheep, and Shimon denies that he received the sheep, or alternatively, he claims he paid back the sheep, or alternatively, he rode the sheep, or he used it in some way. What would that come under in our Mishnah?
Gzelos.
That's called gzelos. Now we move on to chavolos. Okay, chavolos is what's called in modern English assault and battery. Have you ever heard that phrase? And that's where you physically injure a person. Take a look at Rashi on the second line. Rashi says, Hachovel bechavero, if he injures a person, chayav bechamisha dvarim, he has to pay five different categories of payment, of compensation. And if you want to know where that is in Shas, it's not here in Sanhedrin, but rather it's in Bava Kamma. Now, these five categories of payment are very unique. They're not classic, what you'd call compensation. I'll give you an example. If, as a result of the chavola, the nechbal, the victim, cannot work. So, and again, today you may have unemployment insurance, but back in the day they didn't have unemployment insurance. That's called sheves. Sheves means how much money did I lose by the fact that I couldn't go to work. You know, if you, chas v'shalom, would break someone's leg and then that person can't show up at work for a month or two or three, he doesn't have... So that compensation is very unique. Why? Because you didn't actually damage him. You only prevented him from enjoying a profit. You know, I'm finding it very difficult to go on here without a simple black thing, so I'm going to take a break here because I'm very frustrated. I got to write this down
to that top drawer.
Because again, I want Sanhedrin to be on the list of candidates, you know, for...
Bring one maybe?
What's in that top drawer?
Let me look in the office. If you
it looks like there's a green one here. I don't
All right, let's use a green one. Thank you.
Should I check it and see if it's permanent or not permanent? I don't know.
Again, unless it's all dried out.
Yeah, white mark board.
Okay. So we have here the following. We have number one, dini momenos. We have number two, gzelos. Okay, the difference is dinimomenos, he denies a chov, which is abstract. Here he denies a be'en, right, which is a physical, concrete object. And then we get to what's called chavolos. Now, chavolos is very unique. Why? Because of a principle called grama. Okay? What do you say?
Cause.
Cause. Yeah, if I cause you a loss in an indirect way, okay? We'll call it indirect. So that's called chavolos. Meaning, if I, let's say, embarrass a person as a result of this chavola, like the Gemara has a case where he embarrasses him by blowing a shofar in his ear, and he goes partially deaf, he loses part of his power of hearing. In such a case, that payment is an indirect. In other words, it's not that I took an object of yours and I destroyed it, but rather as a result of this act of chavola, you suffer certain damages. So that's called grum. And all that comes under the category called chavolos. Now the Mishnah says bishlosha. In other words, even though in each one of these cases that we mentioned, called gzelos and chavolos, we're talking about some criminal act, nevertheless, it still is considered dinimomenos. It's still judged under the restrictions and the requirements of civil law, which requires how many judges? Three judges. We don't need more than three judges. So again, even though you and I might say this is criminal law and we're dealing with punishment, but nevertheless, since the punishment is monetary in nature, it only means that he digs into his pocket and he pays. It's not going to be like a case where we give him malchus. You know, we have to give him 39 lashes, which is going to come later in the Mishnah, which requires a much larger business that's made up of 23 judges. Here, we're talking about monetary payment. And if it's monetary payment, even from a criminal act, then it comes under dine mominus, means we only require the bare bones basic bezdin, which is a makeup of how many judges? Three judges. Okay, now from gzela we move into something that's very similar, which is called gneva. Okay, does anybody know what gneva is? No.
Robbing at night?
At night, exactly. Gneva means stealthily, so it doesn't have any face-to-face confrontation between the assailant and his victim. Here, like David mentioned before, he sneaks into his house, he burrows into underground, and that's called the gneva.
Burglary versus robbery.
Burglary versus armed robbery. So in the case of burglary, there's something called kefel and dalet v'hei, which means he has to pay double, or in certain specific cases, he has to pay even four times or five times its value. Clearly, we're dealing with criminal law. But here, the criminal law takes on, it's like one notch higher. In the case of gzelos, he pays only the value of the object that he stole, right? So, for example, if Shimon stole Reuven's sheep, and the market value of the sheep at the time of the gzela was 100, that's what he pays. Here, in the case of gneva, he's going to pay 200. Clearly, the payment itself indicates a kind of a punitive criminal law, because otherwise, why is he paying double? It must be because gneva is a worse crime than gzela. Now, you and I would say intuitively, what difference does it make whether he borrows his way stealthily into his house as a burglar and he steals something, or whether he he puts a gun to his head and he steals something, you know, your money or your life? In both cases, it would seem to be equally criminal in action. But the halacha sees, the Torah itself sees gneva, which is burglary, as a worse criminal act than outright gzela. You know, like, if you remember, I don't know if you would, I don't want to be choshed you that as children you watch television, but if, chas v'shalom, you did, you remember the westerns, the old western movie, you know, where the guy comes with a little kerchief around his nose and his mouth, gets on a train, you know, or whatever he does, and he goes around to each person sitting on the train, right? That's called gzela. Believe it or not, that's considered halachically less of a violation of a criminal act than digging into someone and burglarizing him. David, why is that so?
No, I'm just curious why with the gazelle there's no punishment. In other words, if he was given, let's say, Hatsi Nezak or something, but with no punishment, he pays back what he stole, but nothing on top of that. That's
correct. So in the case of gazelle, the punishment for gazelle is what's called psul edus, that he's no longer trusted in a court of law. He has to go through a whole process to reinstate himself into the parsha of edus, of testimony. And that's the punishment for gzela. Now, every gazlan violates a law of lo tigzel. So the question is, why doesn't he get malchus? Why doesn't he get 39 lashes for that as a criminal? So again, I don't want to get off on a tangent because this requires the Masech de Makis, but if you can make a note of it in your mind, that's called the Lav HaNitak Liesen. And the Torah says that whenever you can rectify a Lav, a violation of a Lotaseh, by fulfilling an essay, then you don't get Malkus. The Malkus is meant as a Tikkun, you know, to fix up the Lotaseh, but if you can fix it up by fulfilling an essay, so that's enough of a Tikkun and you don't require Malkus. So that's the case of Gzela. What's the essay of Gzela? Well, Hashav is Gzela. I mean, so yeah. It says, Veheshiv is Gzela Shar Gazal. So that makes Gzela into a Lava Nithakla essay. Okay. In any event, in the case of Gneva, although again you would probably apply the principle of Lava Nithakli essay, but nevertheless there's a monetary punishment. It's monetarily punitive. And he's going to have to pay kefal. So if you take a look in the Mishnah, again, we'll get back to Nezek v'chatzi Nezek in just a moment, but Tashlume Kefel, if you underline those words, Tashlume Arba v'chamisha, those are pure criminal compensations. In other words, the element of compensation has nothing to do with the loss that the victim suffered, because why are you paying him 200? You know, why are you paying him an extra 100%? It's purely punitive in nature. Nevertheless, since it's a compensation in money, then any punitive payment comes under the law of Dini Mamonos. So Dini Mamonos now is expanding. You know, it's like a mushroom. That's mushrooming. It includes not only the case of a malve and a love, where the love, you know, refuses to pay, but it also includes the case of gzelos, which means that the shomer denies that he received the object, or the shomer used the object for his own purposes, or someone who sticks his hand into Yenim's pocket and he steals something. But it also includes the case of a ganov who burglarizes someone and has to pay punitively kefel or arb of chamisha. That's also included under this general rubric of dini mamonos, and therefore three judges is sufficient. Now we have the cases of Nezek v'chatzi Nezek. Okay. So we're going to reverse the order for a moment, and we're going to talk about Chatzi Nezek. Chatzi Nezek is the case of a shor tam. So if an animal like an ox gores on the first three occasions, then he only pays the owner of the shor who was negligent in watching the shor, he pays 50% of the damages. Now, in this case, we would have said that he pays nothing. What's the logic to say that he should pay nothing until the Torah comes along to be mechadish that he has to pay chatzi nezek?
It's a normal thing for an animal.
No, normal or abnormal? I didn't hear what you said.
Normal. No,
an
animal.
No, it's abnormal, right? Because again, we're talking about a short time. A short time is a case where the negicha, in other words, its goring was unanticipated. It's like we have a halacha. I don't mean to compare it of cheskes kashrus, that a person is innocent until proven guilty. So a shor is also considered innocent until God did not create a shor with a natural propensity to want to damage. And if a shor does so, then it's unusual. It's unanticipated. So you really shouldn't make me pay anything. I had no idea until the shor proves himself on three occasions over and over consistently that he goes out and gores. He's obviously a belligerent animal. Then I have to. So chatzi nezek really is a kind of a knas. Okay, if this would work, I would write the word knas on the board. So if you could please write it down, it's going to come up over and over again if we do learn Sanhedrin, which again remains to be decided. But the word knas is kuf nun samach, which means it's a penalty. And the purpose of that penalty is to impose a certain moral or ethical obligation upon a person that goes beyond what you and I would have considered normal ethics. In other words, within the context of normal ethics, if I have a shahr and I have no reason to believe that this shahr is belligerent, then the laws of ethics don't require me to lock up the shahr, you know, with a chain and keys, because it might become belligerent. But yet the Torah says no. We're going to require a higher level of ethical behavior, and you're going to have to worry about someone else's damages. We're going to impose upon you a fine, which is called a knas, a penalty of chatzi nes.
Is that with chasra or not?
With what?
Is that with a warning or without warning?
Okay, so the warning would be the following. After each one of the negichas, then we're going to warn the owner. So what we're going to do is the following. The first negicha took place without any warning whatsoever. We had no clue to anticipate the belligerent act of the animal. Once the animal was belligerent on one occasion, we call in the owner of the animal, we testify against him, you better warn. Okay, he violated the warning, and the animal was nogeach a second time. Call him in a second time, give him a second warning. Now he's nogeach a third warning. Now again, there's no exoneration. Now we warn him for a third time. Three times we've warned you about the animal, it's proven itself to be an animal, or she's proven herself to be an animal that is belligerent. From now on, you pay Nezek Sholim, you pay the entire damage.
But the subsequent ones before that, the first, second, third, he pays half after the warning?
Correct.
Okay.
That's Machlokas Abaye V'Rova in Masech Basra. According to Abaye, already on the third Negicha, he has to pay because twice he violated Basra. Okay, but I don't want to, I don't want to go. Again, you know, to learn Sanhedrin, especially the first Mishnah Sanhedrin, you have to know everything to know anything. But we don't have to know anything. We just have to know what we call Taitz. You know, we have to know how to translate the Mishnah. Now, what do we skip so far? We skip Nezek. Says Rashi, what's Nezek? Third line down, at the end of the third line from the top. Deshara Mu'at. Okay. Now, Deshara Mu'at means it's already proven itself. On how many occasions?
Three.
So it's already the fourth Negicha. When it gets to the fourth Negicha, then we're talking about Deshara Mu'at. Deshara Mu'at will have to pay the full damages. Now this is very similar to what we spoke about earlier called chavolos. Chavolos means physical assault, because again, even though I didn't assault you, but my animal assaulted you, that's also similar, if you follow my point. So no, I didn't take a hammer and hit you over the head, you know, but my animal did, so to speak. I don't mean it literally. And therefore, we're not exactly sure why the Mishnah had to categorize Nezek as a separate category. Rashi has a second case of Nezek. Oh, this is the fourth line down from the top. Adam Sheiziko. Adam Sheiziko means Adam Hamazik. So if I take a hammer and I break your table, deliberately, let's say, if we want to be very dramatic about it, then I have to pay the full damages. That's called Adam Hamazik. And Gemara Parach, Hainu Chavola. I mean, what's the difference between the case of Chavola, where a person, you know, he hurt someone physically, and someone who hurt and damaged someone's possessions, his property? In both cases, we have a Chavola. So the Gemara wants to know, which Rashi is already anticipating what we're going to see in the Sugya, why the Mishnah felt compelled to add Nezek as a separate category. It's almost the Kal Vachomer. You know, in the case of Chavolos, all you need is a Bezin of three, and that's a pretty, you know, that's a pretty heavy criminal act, you know, to physically assault someone. So how much more so if you damage someone's property? All we should need is just be sufficient to have three judges.
You mentioned before that Chavola implies Gromah. But if you take a hammer and you bash the guy's table, that's not
correct. So again, I don't remember, but I think the Gemara is going to come up with that svara, that the chiddush of Chavola is that since you would have said that it's only Groma Benizikin, maybe for that all you need is three judges, but maybe when it's actual direct damage, maybe we should require a higher bezdin, a larger bezdin. Okay, then we get to Onis Umafata. Now, Onis Umafata is going to be an introduction to tomorrow's Shia. Because tomorrow's Shia will be a Mirtz Hashem on the third parak of Ksuvus. Because again, we're testing the waters this week. You know, we hopefully by the end of the week we'll come to some conclusion about what, you know, what we want to learn. That's what I call consensus. So the opening Mishnah of the third parak of Ksuvus addresses these two cases of Ones Umefata. Okay, now let's translate this literally. Ones means rape, and Mefata means seduction. So the difference being, in the second case, she agrees to have this relationship with him. Now, who is she? She is what's called a Nara Besula. You'll see this in Rashi, in the skinny lines of Rashi. It's the second of the skinny lines. You want to underline the words Nara Besula. Okay, now in this case, Nara is a girl of the age of 12. And during the 6-month period between her 12th birthday and becoming 12 and a half, she's called a Nara. Once she hits that half year birthday, she becomes a Bogeres. Once again, a word that I would have to write on the board, but you'll write it down on your side there if you can. Bet Gimel Resh Tav. Bogeris. Now, in the case of a Nara, and she's never had a relationship before, and her first relationship with this was this one, and it's outside of the framework of marriage, then the Torah imposes a knas. You remember the word knas, a penalty. And here the Torah specifies exactly how much money you have to pay as that penalty, and that's called chamishim kesef. Again, when we get to the third parak of Ksuvus, we're going to have to figure out exactly how much that's worth in our currency. But the Torah says, Chamishim Kesef. Okay, now so far, in Ones Umefata, we are dealing with punitive law, but we're dealing with monetary compensation. And therefore, if the monetary payment of the Knas fits into the pattern that we had until now, that we discussed in cases like Chavolos, or possibly in Chatzinezek, and so forth, then we understand very well why we can get away with the bare bones Bezdin, which is a Bezdin comprised of three judges. But the next case is really fascinating, and that's called Motzi Shemra.
Wait a second. I don't know if it takes us off the shear.
Yeah.
How do they know that she's off shear?
Right, so the Gemara says in Masechet Ksuvos, this is already in the first parak of Masechet Ksuvos, that a woman who's never been married has a cheskas besula. Why? So that's called, again, I'm just telling it to you, not even touching the tip of the iceberg, because again, everything is a sugya. It's called a chazaka de meikara. Chazaka de meikara means that if we can prove at one point in time the situation was X, then until we know for sure it's changed, so you have time T1 and time T2, anything in this timeline between T1 and T2, we assume the original situation still exists. So we know that at time T1, from the moment of her birth, she was a Besula, because every woman is Becheskes Besula when she's born. Then we found out at time T2, when this Ones or Mefata took place, and there are two witnesses testified to that, she became a Be'ula. We assume, straight through, from her birth until the moment of the Ones of Mefata, she's a Besula. That's called a Chazaka de Meikara. Okay, now we're up to Motzi Shemra. Now Motzi Shemra is a whole discussion unto itself. Motzi Shemra, Rashi says, Lo matzasi lebitcha besul. Here's a case where a man marries a woman under the assumption that she had never been with another man, and lo and behold, he comes the next morning running into Bezdin with a claim that I found that she was a Be'ula. Again, in the language of the Gemara at the beginning of Ksuvos, that's called Pesach Pasuach Matzasi. I found an opening. You know, I expected to find her to be a virgin, and she was not. However, the Torah says that we can disprove his claim that he's lying. And that makes him into a motzi shemra, which literally translates as slander. And the Torah says in the case of slander, the onshu oso mea kesef, if we can prove that his claim was false, that he fabricated his claim, that she was a basul in fact, and that has to do with taking out the sheets and showing that there's dam on the sheets and so forth and so on, in that case the Torah says we impose upon him a very severe punishment monetarily of mea kesef. That's twice the amount of an onus of mafata, because he's really ruining her reputation.
Could it just have been mistaken?
Again, we're not learning the sugya, so I'm not even going to answer your question. But you're right, when we learn the sugya, we'd have to go into 50 million details about how we know and how we don't know and what he claims. And in any event, Rabbi Meir is the author of this last part of the mission. He says, Bishlosha. Do you see the word Bishlosha? Divrei Rabbi Meir. Because Rabbi Meir says, yes, there's no question that Motzi Shemra is a criminal act of slander, and the Torah punishes him by paying. But nevertheless, what kind of punishment is it? It's a monetary compensation. He's paying a penalty of 100 kesef. So what difference does it make whether it's 50, whether it's 100, whether it's a case of onus of mafata, whether it's a case of motzi shemra? What's the common link here is that in all these criminal cases, including motzi shemra, the Torah is imposing a monetary compensation, a monetary penalty. So that makes it into dine mamonos, because what's at stake here is money. The chachamim omrim, but here's where the chachamim step up and they argue. Motzi shemra be'esrim v'shlosha. Then in the case of motzi shemra, we're dealing with not a monetary case, but a case of much greater significance. And we'll see that in just a second. And as a result, we jack it up to the next level. Remember, we said there were three levels. Level number one is 3 dayanim. Level number two is 23 dayanim. Until we get to the highest level of 71 dayanim, right? So now we're up to the second level, which is called 23 judges. Why? Why in heaven's tarnation do the Chachamim reject the opinion of Rabbi Meir? After all, in the case of Motzi Shemra, all that's at stake here is a monetary payment, albeit it's a twice the amount of onus of mafata, it's mea kesef. It's something very serious. Oh, the answer is, you have to underline the next five words, mipnei sheyesh bo dine nefashos. Now, both I hear we're getting to what I call heavy, heavy lumbus. You know, until now we were dealing with a lot of different concepts, and I don't know if you felt overwhelmed by all these different concepts as I do. I mean, we're getting, you know, get barraged with so many new ideas and so many new concepts. But here we're getting into really the abstract part of Torah, and that's called lumbus.
Is it like saying that he killed her, basically, in a way? He killed her.
No,
her reputation, in a way.
She would have been killed.
I'm just saying a reputation.
No,
kill a reputation.
No, but the point is that if it's true, she's going to get killed.
Because we're dealing with a case of, again, if I could write this on the board, if not, you'll have to write it on your side, of a nara hama'urasa. What do I mean? Here, there's something called erusin, right? Erusin is the period of time between the original marriage and the nisuin, until he actually consummates the marriage. So there's a 12-month period. Today we do it all together. But back in the day, there's a 12-month period separating between the erusin and the nisuin. Now, the erusin took place a year ago. During that entire year, what's her status halakhically? She's an eishes ish. Now, if he finds her to be a ba'ula, meaning she had a relationship, then the assumption is, and Jerry's going to ask me why, which is a very good point, but the assumption is that she had this relationship during the 12-month period. Now, you might say, well, maybe she had that relationship before the 12-month period. Again, we're going to get into that too. But suffice it to say, if I prove to you, based on the logic of halacha, that we assume she had this relationship, this bia, within the last 12 months, well, guess what? Then she's an eshesisha zinsa. So let's look at Rashi. Dinei nefashos, which in the skinny lines of Rashi, I think is about the fifth or sixth line down. Di im emes haya, if his claim is to be taken as truth, shezinsa tachtov. Now the word tachtov has to be underlined here, because tachtov means during this 12-month period. Tachtov literally translates as under him, meaning once she was an eshesisha to him, and he now claims that she had a bia, he beskila. Then she has to be put to death by stoning. And then Rashi formulates the overriding principle of this second part of the Mishnah, namely that Dine Nefashis Be'inon Chav Gimel. We need 23 judges for anything that has a monetary implication. Say it again, I'm sorry.
You said monetary.
Anything that has a nefashis, a capital implication. Now, Rabbosai, this Mishnah of Chacham makes no sense. I'll tell you why. We're going to have to work very hard to understand this. We would never put a woman to death for an accused crime of in this case, Eishes Isha Zinsa, unless there were two witnesses. Now, he is claiming that he found the Pesach Pasuach. How does he know? How do we know that he does know? He's mistaken, blah, blah, blah. You can go on and on and on from now until doomsday. But the bottom line is there are no witnesses. So if there are no witnesses, she would never be put to death. He's accusing her of a crime that theoretically is a capital crime. And that seems to be enough, from the Chachamim's perspective, to jack up this case to a case that's a capital case and requires 23 judges. Intuitively, we would agree with Rabbi Meir here that all you need is three judges, because there's no way, no how, that we can judge her as a capital punishment based on his claim. So as bad as it is that he fabricated this lie and it's slander and it's terrible and beat him till he's blue, black and blue all over, you know, tar and feather him and all that. But you can't tell me it's Dini Nefashis. He in no way is making a claim that's Dini Nefashis. What he does is, now listen carefully, he sets into motion a process that could lead to putting her to death. Why? Because what happens is, after he makes his claim, then Beis Din is going to try to send out what's called a kol, kuf, vav, lamed, and that's meaning like a clarion call, so to speak. Does anybody remember a case where this woman had a relationship? And they may not have realized when they saw this relationship that she was a married woman. They had no way of knowing. But once the call goes out, they start thinking, well, you know what? We saw this woman have a relationship. Let's go testify. We'll tell you on what day she had the relationship, where it took place. It has to be what's called Eishes Etiochel Azima, so I can tell you who, when, and where it happened. And in such a case, we might be putting her to death. So he's initiating a process by claiming that he found it to be a ba'ula that might lead to her putting to death. And in that case, we judge it, jack it up to the status of Dini Nefashis of the capital case. Again, all this has to be understood. We just learned the Mishnah today. And if this entices you intellectually, then you might vote in favor of Sanhedrin. In any event, let's go on. Makos Bishlosha, the Tanakhama holds that if we have Edim that testify against the person that he ate non-kosher food, or he wore a beged of shatnez, he violated one of the Los Asesha Betorah, and he gets 40 lashes, which really means 39 lashes, then in such a case, according to the Mishnah, we can judge that with three people, because it's less than what? It's less than a capital crime. Do you follow? There's no way we could put him to death. So the Tanakhama, the first Tana of the Mishnah, says that anything that falls below Dini Nefashis, meaning any adjudication where the Beis Din will not come to any capital decision, anything below that is Shlosha. So there's a very important point here in this Mishnah. We open the Mishnah by saying Dini Mamonis B'Shlosha, meaning the number three is indicative of a monetary law. Now we're saying no, the number three is indicative of anything below a capital crime. So even if we're going to give a corporeal punishment, a physical punishment, by beating him up 40 lashes, nevertheless it still comes under Dini Mominus Bishlosha, because it's not Dini Nefashos. You follow Rabbi Osai? Anything that's not Dini Nefashos, according to the Tanakhama of that Mishnah, is ipso facto considered like Dini Mominus, meaning all you need is three judges. The only time the Torah jacks up the requirement from 3 to 23 is only in a case of Dini Nefashos. And if the worst punishment that we can give him is Malkus, then it's not Dini Nefashos. Hence, all we need are three judges. However, Mishum Rabbi Yishmael Amru Bi Esrim Vishlosha. Rabbi Yishmael says that any case of a violation of the law, where two witnesses testify that he's Chayav Malkus for violating a law, again, they gave him Asra, they warned him, he went ahead and he violated the Asra deliberately, and he gets Malkus, that's called Dine Nefashos. And Rashi points out that Rabbi Shmuel in the Gemara is going to derive a yalfusa, meaning a derivation, that Malkos is also considered like Dine Nefashos. Now, on a psychological level, let's just say the following, that when a person is beaten up with 40 lashes, what I'm about to tell you is wrong, but just on a psychological level to get by, it could be that he'll die from it. That's not true, by the way. But do you follow me? It could be that he'll die from it. So any corporeal punishment could possibly mean that he'll die from it. So we have to treat it as a capital crime. And this is something that Rabbi Shmuel is going to derive from Psukim. So let's just summarize two major controversies in our Mishnah, both about whether three suffices or you jack it up to require 23. The first machlokah is going to be about Motzi Shemra, where the Chachamim say the Motzi Shemra initiates a process which could lead to Dini Nefashos, if the Eidim will testify that she had this relationship Tachtov during the 12 months. And the second issue is going to be the case of Malchus, when a person violates a law, and we have to mete out a punishment of 40 malchus. The sheet of Rabbi Shmuel is that in such case we jack up to a Dini Nefashos case and you require 23 charges. Okay. Now the Mishnah goes on to a different discussion. And this has to do with, I think it's called the this is called Ibur Hashan. Correct? So how many months do we have in a year? It depends. Usually it's 12, but like this year, for example, it's 13. So we add an extra word. That's called Ibur. Ibur means pregnant. So it's a pregnant year. And when it comes to a pregnant year, how does Beis Din make that determination that this year should be impregnated? It should be an Ibur Shana. It should be a year with an extra month to it. So that requires an entire process that is very complex. It's gradual. We start with X number of judges, and then we carry it by adding other judges, and there's an entire series of how many judges we need. We start with 3, we go up to 5, then we go up to 7, and this is going to be a process, the culmination of which is a determination that this year should be an Eber year. It should be an extra month. So on the one hand, when we talk about Eber Shana, then we're really talking about Dini Mamonos. Certainly, from the perspective of the Chachamim, who say that anything but Dini Nefashos is called Dini Mamonos, and all you need is 3 judges. But on the other hand, it's a little bit more complicated, because as we said, although we start the process initially with 3 judges, we have to add another 2 judges, and then finally another 4 judges, until we finally culminate with 7 judges, and we're going to need 7 judges in order to determine that this year should be an Ibur Shana. So take a look at Rashi, if you can find a Rashi that starts with Ibur Hashana. He says, Shahayu Bezdin Yoshvim V'roim. Roim means they would judge. Im Tzrichim, do we need La'aber to add an extra month? And what is the whole motivation to add an extra month, like we did this year? Mipneha.
Pesach.
Correct, Mipneha Av. Because Pesach is called Chag Ha'aviv. The Torah specifically, explicitly writes that Pesach has to be celebrated during the spring. Now, what happens is because of the difference between the solar calendar and the lunar calendar, right? The determination of the seasons is based on the solar calendar, but we determine the calendar by the lunar calendar. So there's going to be a discrepancy between the solar calendar and the lunar calendar, and that's going to catch up to us after a certain period of time. Let's say after 3 years or so, what you're going to have is that the lunar calendar is going to place Pesach, the 15th of Nisan, during the winter months. And then we're in really big trouble, because the Torah defines Pesach as the spring. So in order to make up that differentiation, we're going to need what's called Ibur Shana. We're going to have to add a whole new month to make up for the 3 years in which, let's say, there was a discrepancy of 10, it's more like 11, whatever it is, each year times 3 is 3 times 10 is 30. We're going to need an extra month to make sure that we push Pesach down, so to speak. We delay it until Nisan falls into the Chodesh HaAviv. And this process begins with 3 judges, then it's taken to a higher level, which we add another 2 judges until finally we get to 7 judges. That's called Ibur HaShana. But then there's the monthly Ibur HaChodesh. Ibur HaChodesh is the mitzvah that's codified in Parshas Bo, HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodeshim, which makes it incumbent upon the Beis Din to determine when the new month is. And they would have Edim testify in front of the Beis Din that they saw the new month, the new moon. And that requires 3 judges. But you see, in the case of Ibur HaShana, all you need is 3, I'm sorry, in the case of Ibur HaChodesh, all you need is 3 judges. You don't have to add any other judges. So let's read the Mishnah inside, back to the text of the Mishnah. Ibur HaChodesh Bishlosha, Ibur HaShana Bishlosha, Divrei Rabbi Meir. Now, I told you before, but I have to add a little piece to it, that Beis Din will sit and receive witnesses for Ibur HaChodesh who testify that they saw the new moon. But it's a little bit more complicated than that, because very often the Edim don't come into Beis Din for whatever reason. And then what we do is we add an extra day to the month. Instead of a 29-day month, it becomes a 30-day month. That's called Ibur HaChodesh. However, the Ibur HaChodesh, unlike the Ibur HaShana, when you add a full month to the year, suffices 3 judges. You don't have to go beyond the 3 judges. And the reason for that is because if the Edim didn't come in, then it's almost automatic that we're going to add that extra day to the month, because we couldn't sanctify the month on the 29th. We didn't have witnesses to that effect. Then we just simply wait to the 30th, and ipso facto, the 30th becomes Rosh Chodesh. So in any event, 3 judges suffice. However, Ibur HaShana, that's already more complicated. And it says the following. Ibur HaShana B'Shlosha, Divrei Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir says that just like in Ibur HaChodesh, if you want to determine that the Chodesh is a Mole and add the 30th day, all you need is 3 judges. So too, if the determination was that this year needs another extra month in order to guarantee that Pesach would fall out in Chodesh HaAviv, 3 judges are enough. That's Divrei Rabbi Meir. Rav Shimon Gamliel is the one who says that the process of Ibur HaShana is more complex. B'shlosha maschilim, we start with 3 judges. That he agrees to Rabbi Meir. But then, ubechamisha. Why? We add 2 extra judges, jacking it up to 5. Nosim v'nosnim. Nosnim v'nosnim means to
discussion.
What's the word? Discussion?
Yeah.
I was going to use the word deliberation, but discussion is just as good. And during this period of time, when the 5 judges gather together, there's a deliberation. Meaning, the original initial process is that 3 judges say, hey, wait a minute, we're really not doing well here with the lunar calendar. We're going to end up with Pesach prematurely before the spring. Then, at that point, we have to add 2 judges. Now, the reason why we have to add 2 judges is very complex. And for that, we'd have to learn Masechta Rosh Hashanah. As I said, you have to know everything to know anything. And in Masechta Rosh Hashanah, there are all sorts of considerations and the repercussions of adding another month in many different ways. It's not just, the discussion doesn't exhaust itself with Pesach. I mean, there are all sorts of agricultural considerations for the farmers and so forth and so on. So we need a higher Beis Din, and we add 2. The Gomrim, and the final decision the verdict is going to be handed down by Shiva. However, in Gomru Begimel Muberes, even Rav Shimon Gamliel says that this is only Lechatchila. In other words, if all things are ideal, we're going to go and add another 2, get up 5, and then finally we're going to get up to 7, and then we're going to make the decision. But if the Beis Din of 3 judges, like let's say for example they couldn't find any other judges, and they made the decision after long deliberations that we have to add another month, then B'dieved, in such a case, we can rely, even according to Rav Shimon Gamliel, we'll fall back on the decision of the 3 judges. Okay, now at this point in the Mishnah, we're going to discuss what's called the mitzvos hatluyos bi eretz Yisrael, meaning those mitzvos that only apply within the borders of the land of Israel. So, for example, we have smichas zakenim, and we have harifas ha'egla. These mitzvos apply within the land of Israel. So let's start with the easier of the two cases, and that's called Arifas Egla. There's a whole Masechta that's dedicated to that concept called Arifas Egla. What's that Masechta called? Sota. Well, there are two parts of the Masechta Sota, but half of the Masechta is dedicated to Arifas HaEgla. So we find a dead body, a slain body, meaning he was murdered, between two cities. And we do what's called Medida. Medida means we do a measurement. And when we determine which city is the closest city to the location in which we found the body, then that city is obligated in the mitzvah of Arifas Egla, which means they take a calf and they bring it down to a Nachal Eson, a certain specific place, and they have a whole ceremonial procedure called Arifas HaEgla. Now the Beis Din has to determine which city in the two cities, because the slain body is found located in juxtaposition between two cities, which city is the closest city. So for that we need a decision of a Beis Din. Well, so what is the makeup of that Beis Din that goes out and does the Medida, and they measure the exact distance to the city? Very complicated halachas, because a city is defined by not only the populated areas, but the strips of a radius, or call it a circumference, around the city that goes 2,000 amah. And then if there are individual houses, we might have to expand the city. So in any event, this is going to be the process of Beis Din determining whether or not this city, or which city, is chayiv in the mitzvah of Arifas Egla. Then there's something called Smichas Zakenim. And with this we'll conclude for today. Smichas Zakenim means that we pass on the authority to a person and appoint him as a Zakin. Zakin means that he can sit on the Beis Din. So that's called Smicha. Okay? Rashi has a different interpretation of Smichas Zakenim, but that we'll leave for another day. And the question is, how many judges will determine will determine that this candidate is a viable candidate for smicha, in which we put our hands on his head and we determine and declare that he is a zok and he can sit on the Beis Din. Rashi says that smicha's ken has to do with a different parsha, which is called Parhelim Dovar Shel Tzibur. So this is basically the breakdown of the Mishnahs to determine how many judges we need to make up a Beis Din, depending upon which case it is.